Welcome to another episode of the Speak the Truth podcast. I'm your host, Matt Tardio. Today's episode is being sponsored by Yahoo Finance. Today we have a very special guest. His name is Carl Szabo. Now, I interviewed him earlier this week before Israel decided to invade Eastern Rafah, okay? But prior to that, we had an amazing discussion. I'm so glad to have him on. He's the vice president and general counsel over at NetChoice. Additionally, writes for Fox News, and he's been featured on Fox News several different times. And he is also a professor of internet law at George Mason University. Ladies and gentlemen, we are going to have a great discussion today talking about so many topics. We're going to be going over, you know, like how Israel is using AI in order to locate hostages, identify tunnels. We're also going to talk about some of the cybersecurity threats here in the United States, his take on TikTok, and many other topics. And of a brief side note, I let Carl know beforehand that I had a good friend of mine inside of Afghanistan. His name was Nick Szabo. And unfortunately, he had passed away a couple years ago. And that's normally who I think of when I hear the name Szabo. And I warned him beforehand. I was like, I might have a weird slip where I end up calling you Nick. So, Carl, I apologize ahead of time. And just like I had warned him, wouldn't you know it happened? And I decided to leave it in. So, ladies and gentlemen, enjoy this exclusive interview with Carl. All right, so, Nick, sounds thanks good for joining us.
Oh, yeah, thanks. Off to a good start. Call me Nick already.
I mean, I just, it's what I do. I'm sorry. I'm a first name kind of guy. I like doing it. I hope you don't mind.
I love it. I love it. Let's rock and roll.
So you're a tech expert, like huge, you know, and when we start looking at what's going on inside of the Gaza Strip, we've got God only knows how many hostages still remaining alive. And I can say that with confidence. It could be, you know, fewer than 20, it could be as high as 100, maybe 40. Nobody really knows. Hamas isn't saying it. How is technology actually helping the IDF or the Israeli intelligence in order to locate some of these hostages?
So, I mean, let's take a step back and think about the recent attack on Israel, right? You had Iran, I have to be more specific because they're happening all the time. speaking of Iran's launching of 300 missiles into the state of Israel, indiscriminately targeting basically anywhere and everywhere that they could possibly hit, yet they were unsuccessful. Why? Because of a defense system, Iron Dome, as it's commonly phrased. Israel's been under the thumb and threats of foreign adversaries basically its whole existence, where it is shooting down missiles that are constantly being sent in. That is innovative AI-powered technology. It started during the Reagan administration with, you know, essentially you remember Star Wars, and it has evolved ever since then. And what do I mean by AI? Well, essentially, picture this. You got a rocket being launched, and then within a matter of seconds, you have a detection of launch. Its intercept course is basically needs to be plotted, and a response intercept rocket has to be fired almost immediately.
Right.
And that's those are calculations. I mean, if anybody's ever taken like advanced trigonometry and calculus, like this is way beyond that. And so these calculations need to be made immediately. Launches need to be made immediately to intercept those incoming rockets. And that is what AI is really good at. It can detect and respond very quickly. We have used the same technology on American cruise ships for years on incoming rockets from foreign adversaries. This technology is literally saving lives today. Now, to the question, the U.S., how can AI help with respect to the hostages that are being held?
Sure.
Well, if you look back at 9/11, which after all the reports came out and everything, we had the intel. We had the information. We just could not connect the dots. We knew that there was a potential threat with airplanes, maybe, but all these disparate groups weren't able to put those pieces together. Well, if you think about like those spy movies or Beautiful Mind, you see the people with paper all over their house and push pins and yarn everywhere connecting
tin
everything.
Tinfoil hats are on.
Yeah, well, it's not always tinfoil hats, exactly.
I know.
But that's what AI is really good at. It's good at big data analysis. Because unlike you or me or basically anyone else, everything it sees, it remembers perfectly. And something it read a decade ago, it remembers just as well as it does 10 seconds ago. Mm-hmm. So with respect to finding the hostages, what it can do is look at satellite images of the Gaza Strip that have been compiled for decades and begin looking at something as simple as truck movements and people movements in and out of certain areas and begin to connect that to known terrorists and those terrorists being on those trucks. And aggregating all that data, you can begin to map out the entrance and exit points of the tunnels. You can see dirt being moved and begin to create a map. And all this is doing really is taking lots of data and analyzing, much as the same way somebody at the bottom of the basement at CIA would do, but it does it way more efficiently, it does it way more effectively. And that's actually helping to better identify this maze of tunnels that lie beneath the Gaza Strip and help the IDF free those hostages.
Yeah. So, you know, we used to call it like patterns of life or pattern of life analysis. Yeah. So an example would be, you know, you have a house that might be big enough for, I don't know, 3 to 5 people, or a building or a structure that typically takes 3 to 5 people, but there's a max number of people that can go in it and out of it that, you know, the average family is going to have coming in and out. So are you saying that this AI likely is going to be, you know, measuring that type of information out, saying, well, hey, 30 people entered this house today, only 5 came out. So there's probably a tunnel entrance, and that's something they're going to be focusing and then looking at?
Exactly. I mean, one of the challenges that Israel and the IDF in particular are facing with this is those tunnels, those mazes are being built in the most innocuous of locations. Not as though they're Hamas is using military installations to build the entrances and exits of these tunnels. They're using schools and hospitals, for example. Mm-hmm. And you would see a bunch of people come in, and as you point out, very few come out. And it's not like a clown car, right? You can't just cram everyone in and they disappear. They've got to go somewhere. And that's where you begin to figure out where these tunnels and these entrances are. And that's how you begin to go in and find them. Because one of the big challenges that the IDF is facing is identifying friend from foe. This is something the US has faced for decades, if not centuries. You saw it in wars like Vietnam or Korea, or even in our fighting in World War II in the Far East, for example, mm-hmm. where you don't know who is military and who is not, because as soon as they take off the uniform, you don't know. And so using AI, you can better detect who is and is not a threat and better identify where the entrances and exits locate. And as you point out, it's just data analysis, but it's doing a better job and it's doing it faster and it's providing actionable intelligence to people on the ground.
Yeah. So one of the ways I like to describe the intelligence network for a lot of people that don't know is you have, you know, your people on the ground, or you have your people that are collecting it, and then it basically gets uploaded into a cloud. And like you said, you know, prior to 9/11, there was a huge disconnect. And so now essentially everything is connected in one location, and it's on analysts to basically start linking these things together and then start pushing it back down to get it actionable to the people on the ground. And so AI is going to have a huge part in helping get that information together and start piecing those together to actually have humans confirm it before it starts getting pushed down.
Yeah, I mean, this is literally life-saving technology. And well, you know, one of the things to be really proud of, this is developed in the US. I mean, don't get me wrong, Israel and their security development, their data security, their tech development is incredible. They have some of the best tech and data security experts on the planet, because fun fact about Israel, you can't really grow much in a desert. So they actually needed to grow something else as a product to sell. And it's intellectual property for a lot of the time. But American companies like Google and Amazon are actually providing the cloud backend place to store the data, as well as the data analysis. And what's really disheartening is you see a lot of the protests on campus, but it's not just on campus of universities. It's on the campus of many of these American businesses. So right. Google, Amazon, they are literally having their own employees take up measures to block workers from getting to work, block their co-workers from doing their job, because they believe that, oh, providing any assistance to Israel is inherently bad, which A, completely ignores who is, you know, our friends in the Middle East. But simultaneously, it is ignoring the reality of, one, this is saving lives, and two, your job is to do work, not to be a political activist. And so what I am really encouraged to see is a lot of American businesses like Google, like Amazon, are starting to actually take the necessary steps and fire, terminate these employees who would rather protest than produce the actual work product that they're there to do. And so good on them. But simultaneously, we as Americans need to continue to provide Israel its necessary assistance to fight and address this counteroffensive to the October 7th attacks.
So while we're on the same subject of, you know, AI and how Israel's is being very advanced, so is the United States, and obviously they're sharing of technology. How do you go about explaining that for October 7th with the amount of coverage? I mean, these guys are out, you know, running around on carts with parachutes, you know, using paragliders and things like that. Like, that would take training. Surely AI would have picked up on that. Surely an analysis would have picked up on that type of stuff. 5,000 rockets being fired. They have to move those in a stage. How did that go undetected, in your opinion? Or did it go undetected, or did it go detected and it's just a mistake? Like, what's your take on it?
I mean, that's really a big question. I think Benjamin Netanyahu's career is hinging on the answer to those questions. What I expect to see is something similar to what we had after 9/11, which is a pretty broad-based investigation of what happened. I mean, Israel prides itself on some of the best spy intelligence in the world. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's famous, it's infamous, depending on who you ask. And how did they screw this up this big? And what I would like to see, and what we're likely to see out of Israel, which we didn't really see too much out of the 9/11 commissions, is heads are going to be held accountable. People are going to lose their jobs, and steps are actually going to be taken. So following 9/11, the U.S.'s response was to create the Department of Homeland Security, which was supposed to be this top-level organization to make sure information sharing and all the intelligence goes everywhere it does. It didn't. It's been a complete disaster. And no one really was held accountable. I think you're going to see something very, very, very different in the state of Israel. You're going to see a lot of resignations or forced resignations, and you're going to see a lot of reformations. I think simultaneously, you're going to see a lot more adoption of artificial intelligence. And finally, I think one of the biggest challenges is this really, you know, blindsided a lot of people. In part, it might have been hubris. It might have just been something as simple as taking your eye off the ball. Look, I'm Jewish. I'm pretty fluent in Israeli history. And if you look back at one of the other major attacks on Israel, the Yom Kippur Wars, mm-hmm. back in the 1970s, that was, once again, Israel getting caught with its pants down. The Arab countries launched their attack on our most holy holiday when everyone was kind of a temple.
Right.
And this is something similar. So I think, once again, awareness, being on guard, is going to go up a lot more in the state of Israel, and it needs to stay there, not taper off like it has since those last attacks back in the 1970s and 1980s.
You know, when I look at that and I analyze it, I think there's a lot more that goes into, you know, just people setting things up. You know, I mean, 5,000 rockets, it takes a lot of people to move that equipment around and get it in place. But it's happening in a decentralized manner, so the left hand doesn't necessarily know what the right's doing, you know, while they're out there doing that. With that being said, there would still been a lot of, you know, human intelligence reported up, along with signal intelligence, along with, you know, any of the sensors that they have overhead that would have picked up on all that. I personally, when I look at that, I just think that Israel was in one of those danged if you do, danged if you don't situations, because had they held up a smoking gun and launched a preemptive attack, they would have still been accused of lying. They would have been accused of genocide, and it would have just kind of been there. So I can't see a scenario where they didn't see it happening. I think somebody said, no, we're going to hold off on this one. We're going to wait. That would be my assessment.
Really, no, that's a really astute point. I mean, it's one of my many frustrations, you know, just from a, you know, not in my role at NetChoice, not in my role as a professor at George Mason, just me as a Jewish dad, right?
Yeah.
Our temple was desecrated literally this past weekend here in the United States of America. And this is unfortunately something that has been around for way, 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 way too long. You look at the UN, the constant resolutions against Israel for being the bad guys. They're always the bad guys. They're never the victims. They were the victims for maybe a day, maybe on October 8th, people said, poor Israel, but immediately they went back to their old adage of,
sure,
you know, get rid of the nation. So I think that's a really astute point of, if Israel takes the proactive measures to defend itself, it is considered engaging in, quote, genocide.
Yeah, which they'd be called genocidal. So I think it's that simple, honestly. You know, I think people are looking at this and saying it's a, you know, it's a failure or it's a conspiracy. I don't think it's any of that. I think Israel quite literally would have just been accused of genocide right off the bat. And they chose not to at the end of the day. And I also don't think they were aware of the scale because of how decentralized, yeah, something like that would have been. But that, you know, it's sad. It's really sad. I don't know how else to put that. You know, even today, you know, I had one of the latest propaganda videos to come out of Rafah, you know, when Israel responded to the attack that took four of their soldiers' lives. You know, there's a guy standing there with his camera on and he's focused in on a specific area, and you end up seeing an airstrike come in and he records it and he goes, ah, see, they're striking the tents. But in the same video clip, you see a rocket shooting straight up into the sky out of the same area that sympathetically went off. And it's like, there's a reason your camera was trained on this area. But the problem is people are taking that information. They don't know what they're looking at. They don't know how to properly assess it. And they see a bomb hitting in a tented area. And they don't know how to properly assess that. And that, I think, is where all this like hate and frustration is coming from. And when we go back to what you're talking about with Google, and you have all these, you know, employees that are rising up, and I believe that they were rightfully fired, because there is a issue, and I want to touch base on TikTok in a second, but there's an issue because it seems like there's one side of information that is getting highly censored and highly pushed. You know, one side is being censored and the other one is being highly pushed. I built some pretty decent accounts, you know, online on social media platforms. And when I put information out like that, they immediately get ripped down. They immediately get censored. There's no misinformation. There's nothing against community guidelines. And yet it's gone. I mean, I know you're here to talk about the tech side, but
ladies and gentlemen, you know, I'm a pretty busy guy. And you also know that I'm a reasonable human being. I work from sunup to sundown, but I don't believe that my work alone is going to be enough to secure the future of my family, right? Like actual financial security. So I invest. But the problem is that I'm always really busy. So I've looked over the years for a place for me to, you know, view my portfolio, what's going on in the stock market, and then also see the relevant news of what's going on for the day so I can make educated decisions on when to buy and sell. I'm telling you right now, all the way back, you know, before 2010, I was using Yahoo Finance. They're the number one finance destination, and they produce a holistic look at the financial news cycle, including breaking news, original editorial perspectives, analysis, ratings, independent research, customizable charts, and so much more. You can securely link your brokerage accounts for a unified view of your wealth, including your 401k and other investments. Very important. A comprehensive perspective is what sets apart great investors, and it's how Yahoo Finance ensures that you have the insight to look at your wealth in its entirety. So for comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit the brand behind every great investor, yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com. Again, that's yahoofinance.com.
That's one of the big things I do at NetChoice. So I actually have two cases before the U.S. Supreme Court on this issue. We had oral arguments about 2 months ago. It's called NetChoice v. Murphy and NetChoice v. Paxton and Murphy v. NetChoice. And then similarly, I've got a bunch of cases, one against the state of California. And then there are the cases also being heard before the U.S. Supreme Court. Essentially, it's called Missouri v. Biden. And all of them are centered around exactly what you're talking about. It's the content removal policies and the government intervention into free speech. Now, there's kind of two avenues that I look at this. One is, can a private business decide what is appropriate for its customers and its consumers? And for that, the free market, free expression, First Amendment side of me says yes. Look, I'm a Republican, I'm conservative. I get frustrated when NetChoice members make decisions I don't like, but it is absolutely their right. What I draw the line at, this is what our cases before the U.S. Supreme Court are centered on, and this is what the Missouri and Louisiana State Attorney General's cases against Biden are on, is government intervention. When the government forces somebody to host content that they do not want to host and remove content that they do not want to remove. And if you recall, it was about a year and a half ago now, the Twitter files first came out. Elon Musk buys X, and he makes this big dump of Twitter files. Now, fun fact, my email was in that first tranche of Twitter files. That was before they started redacting email addresses. So all of a sudden, I'm leaving Temple with my family and my phone is just going nuts. I'm like, what's going on? But what we learned out of that, and what we were actually, the email that I had sent to the folks at Twitter, were people on the Hill were hopping mad about the Hunter Biden laptop story.
Sure.
And we learned how the government leveraged its power to shut down free speech. It denied speech it didn't want. And then as the Twitter files came further and further out, we learn how the Biden administration started putting its finger on things like discussions of COVID, lab leak theories, effectiveness of certain treatments, removal of other pieces of content. You have President Joe Biden, the leader of the free world, coming out and saying, and I'm quoting, unfortunately, Facebook is literally killing people by hosting such content. And so you're absolutely right. It is terrifying that some content gets promoted, some content gets removed, especially when that is being done at the behest of the government. And that is where it gets really scary. Now, what I really do like, just as a quick aside, what X has done, I think, is really innovative. So they created their community notes. So they basically say, go ahead and post, but then we're going to let the community add addendums to it and say, make comments. And very recently, I think the administration got angry with one of the community notes that actually added truthful context to a deceptive comment. So then you get the comment, but then you get the context. And that's a way of letting the community kind of engage in that moderation at scale. So it's a really novel approach that I'm excited to see.
Yeah, I think the one that you're actually referring to had to do with like the status of the economy and how it's getting better. Yeah. And then if I remember right, I think that was actually the one. I saw that. I mean, laughed.
Really all they had were pictures from the supermarket, but to dismiss that economy getting better argument. But
Well, how do you feel, you know, and I'm curious on the legal side on how this plays out, because, you know, if I want to publish this video, for example, and, you know, I have somebody that pays me to read an ad. Right. I have to check a box when I upload this that I'm being paid to read said ad, that this is an actual advertisement. There was a social media influencer that came out last week and talked about how the Biden administration had been paying her to put pro-Biden content on her TikTok account. And because it didn't fall under advertisement traditional, because she's not selling anything. How does that play out legally? You know, like
non-legal advice. So that's my disclaimer for you. Non-legal advice.
Sure.
Here's the problem. And this is kind of one of those loopholes in the law. When it comes to nonprofits, so essentially when you set up a company, you can set a couple different tax designations. You can do typically in my universe, 501c3, 501c4, 501c6. Okay, so 501c6 is what NetChoice is. We are a corporation, your typical corporation trade association. If we were to pay anybody, that's a corporation. Nonprofits are like your church or your NPR or whatever. The challenge there is if they were to pay somebody to do promotions, a nonprofit, then that's not considered an advertisement because they are a quote nonprofit. So typically we would think of a nonprofit as like your church or your synagogue or whatever. Right. But there are a lot of political nonprofits out there, a lot of them. They're designated 501c3 or c4. So what happened is Joe Biden had a political campaign, usually gets slightly similar category as a nonprofit. They could pay somebody to do an ad, but since it's not for an actual good, like what you would do, they don't have to disclose it as an advertisement.
That's
so and the Federal Trade Commission actually has no authority over it because it's not a corporation. So they can't even go after that YouTube or TikTok or whomever influencer for doing a political ad because it's not the Federal Trade Commission's jurisdiction because it's not a corporation. It is a major loophole in the law. So you can engage in deceptive advertising so long as it's political. And that's really what a lot of you're seeing when it comes to, I mean, whether it's Joe Biden for president or whether it is, you know, the Palestinian anti-Israel movement, they can do these end runs around reporting requirements and accountability and use influencers without having to disclose.
Right. Well, while we're on the topic of, you know, TikTok and influencers and everything, how big of a threat would you assess TikTok to be to the American citizens with the current way that it's set up?
So it's a tough question to answer because the libertarian kind of free enterprise part of me worries when you have government deciding what websites we can visit and what apps we can download. That kind of really starts to scare me because one day I could easily foresee the Biden administration declaring Truth Social or Rumble or some conservative leaning organization to be, quote, threat to security or threat to democracy, and therefore deny access. And it's really scary throughout history. the greatest seizures of power by government have been on the basis of, quote, security threat. The thing to note, I think, with TikTok is there's a lot of unknown unknowns. So the Biden administration allegedly has been looking into this through what's called CFIUS. It's the Council of Foreign Investment in the United States, CFIUS. And they apparently have conclusive reports one way or the other, but they're unwilling to reveal them. They're unwilling to make them available to the public. And I think that's for political reasons, right? You see President Biden trying to cultivate supporters, allies, and even engage in political advertisements on TikTok. So if, for example, CFIUS came out with a report, the US agency, saying TikTok is dangerous, well, then how can the president then be using this system? If CFIUS comes out and says everything's A-OK, then Biden gets labeled as pro-China. So it's one of these unfortunate things where you and I and every one of your listeners have literally spent millions of dollars in taxpayer money doing this investigation to no effect. And it is our right as American citizens to have transparency in our government. So I want to know what CFIUS found. Because if it is that scary, we should know.
Yeah, that's a very solid point, you know, and it's something that I actually haven't even thought about myself as it goes into that report. And I'm curious myself. Okay, so that's where we're at on TikTok. What about, you know, as far as AI goes here on the home front, like using AI here on the home front, like good thing for our government, good thing for the U.S. citizens, or absolutely abused? We need to be on the lookout for this.
No, I joked with a friend of mine. They took a little offense because they're engaged in AI. It's like, AI is the new crypto, I think was my exact phrase. If you look at every single business out there, roll back the clock 5 years, everyone's talking about crypto and Bitcoin. Now everyone's talking about AI and integration. The fundamental difference is crypto, while good and everything, is kind of like a buying gold or silver, something like that. It's not truly novel. Artificial intelligence is truly transformative technology. And like any, you know, like Spider-Man's uncle said, with great power comes great responsibility. But like any new tool, it has the ability to do amazing good or potentially amazing bad. And what really excites me about artificial intelligence, so the reason that I'm really like gung-ho on AI, I look at three things in particular, three challenges that we as a society have yet to figure out: cancer, clean, renewable energy, basically cold fusion, and feeding the world with good crop yields. We spend billions of dollars with the smartest scientists at all three of these problems: cancer, cold fusion, and crop yields. Yep. And we can't crack the code. Something's missing. And what I'm expecting is artificial intelligence can actually be used to test, analyze, and retest new approaches on these types of problems in fractions of seconds. And it can learn, it can figure out what's not working, what is working. And I think it might actually be the secret sauce, because if it can solve one of those problems, that is a world-changing thing. I mean, imagine this, we cured cancer. I mean, just think about that sentence, or we cured cold fusion. I mean, just amazing, world-changing discoveries. And I think AI can actually bring that about. Now, the thing that scares me, though, is not the Terminator or AI is racist, because I think, yes, I love science fiction. Yes, James Cameron is an amazing director, and I love all his movies. And I cry at the end every time Arnold gives the thumbs up. Yeah. But the real discussions on AI and what scares me is actually what is coming out of this administration, our administration, which is kind of a complete takeover of artificial intelligence. So one of the things that's kind of gone undiscussed is what's called Biden's executive order on artificial intelligence. Executive order is actually the longest executive order in American history. It was on the backs of something called the Defense Production Act, which created in the 1960s, so we can actually, you know, get factories to build tanks. And the reason it was executed is because, and I wish this were a joke, President Biden went to Camp David and saw the new Mission Impossible, which has AI as the bad guy. And he decides to say, we need to control that. And why is control bad? Yes.
That's true?
Yes, it is a terrifying... I really do worry what happens when he sees Godzilla and how how he responds to that, or Deep Impact. But
Event Horizon, the ISS.
Exactly, yeah. Well, Event Horizon's a good story on the dangers of space travel. True, that, you know, that's a true story. But the executive order is literally figuratively hand tying America's developers today. One of the things that we have seen already out of this administration is a move towards a licensure regime and a you can't do it until the government lets you do it. So if you think about the way the United States is always engaged in law, we don't outlaw tools, we outlaw bad actions. Going back to my hammer example, right? Hammer can be used to build a house, but it can also be used to break a window. We don't outlaw hammers, we outlaw destruction of private property.
Right.
So if AI is used to commit fraud, deception, misrepresentation, election interference, I can go on and on. We have laws to address that today, right? Fraud, deception, election interference. So there's this misconception that AI is unregulated. False. It is heavily regulated because that's how America regulates. We regulate bad actions. The guy who did the deepfake of Joe Biden up in New Hampshire on elections went to prison, not for AI, but for election interference and fraud and violations of the Wiretap Act and similar things. So we didn't need new laws. We needed more law enforcement. So what we are seeing is two things. One, we're seeing an effort to cramp down and prohibit innovation unless government lets you do it, which is really scary because then the good developers will never get off the ground. Bad actors, as we know, don't follow the law because, well, they're bad actors. And the US will be left behind. We will go from a tech maker to a tech taker as foreign adversaries, whether it's in China, Iran, or somewhere in Russia, are developing the next level of AI. And we suddenly become beholden to them for their technology and their innovations. And then the second problem is, and this is also systemic through this nation, is this call for more laws. We don't need more laws. We need more law enforcement. Mm-hmm. So if the concern is that people will use AI for bad things, then put the bad actors behind bars. That's right. The hard work that a lot of people don't want to do in this administration. It's easier to get up in front of a podium than it is to put boots on the ground and put bad actors behind bars. And so that's kind of where I'm really excited about AI, but I'm really scared that our government is going to kneecap our innovation and prevent America from really taking us to the next level.
Sure. You know, and like you said, that, you know, AI could be used for good. It can also be used for bad, just like anything else, just like a hammer. When we start looking at some of the recent news that has just came out, you know, three European countries just came out and are saying that Russia is looking at sabotage across the EU, possibly here in the United States as well. You know, we had a couple mishaps, it would appear to be, at some ammunition factories over the last month. And again, that's how sabotage is conducted, though. How vulnerable is the U.S., how vulnerable is the U.S. grid, for example, our power grid? Just use the power grid. How vulnerable is the U.S. power grid to something like that?
It's terrifying. What was it? Back in 2005, 2006, the entire city of Manhattan went dark. Much of the Northeast went dark for a couple of days. And it was bedlam. It was absolutely bedlam. And that was because essentially somebody flipped a switch somewhere and a server went down and the entire Northeast lost power. Our critical infrastructure, whether it is the electrical grid, the water grid, all of that is incredibly accessible and subject to intrusions. We're actually seeing constant attacks all the time via cybersecurity threats. A lot of underreported cybersecurity threats are happening all the time. You have the United Healthcare data breach, which happened recently. As a result, a lot of people couldn't get prescriptions. My brother, for example, has a genetic illness. He needs his meds. But because of a cybersecurity hack against United Health, Americans could not get their prescriptions filled.
Jeez.
Because it broke the chains.
Jeez.
The U.S. government just recently got hacked. So almost the entire U.S. government operates on one operating system, Windows, Microsoft Windows. And a report came out, a really scathing report, shows that, Microsoft actually... It detects these security breaches and these security vulnerabilities and then fails to patch them. because they have kind of been locked in to this really lucrative government contract. And government's not going to just up and abandon Microsoft. I think they should kind of decrease their dependency. But because they have a guaranteed monopoly, they're not doing the security checks that they need to. So our entire government system is subject to what I refer to as, and what cybersecurity experts refer to as, single point of failure. So a single security vulnerability in Windows exposes the entire government operating system. Mm-hmm. And I'm not just talking GAO, Government Accountability Office. We're not just talking IRS. We're talking the entire alpha and omega of FBI, military, CIA. And that's really, really scary.
Are you familiar with the hack that China did back in 2012 on the Pentagon?
Yeah.
You are? So I was on active duty and I was overseas when that took place, and they actually shut down the entire system. So for those that are watching that don't know, you have the Nipper, which is essentially the unclassified section of the DoD's computer system. Then you have the SIPR, which is the secret the secret portion of the system, and then it goes up. They actually ended up, if I remember correct, hacking into the Nipper, and they made their way all the way inside of the Pentagon. And it's scary because I've been on that system and I've dug through a bunch of the files that are on there, and there's stuff on there that maybe it shouldn't be. You know what I mean? Examples, videos, things of that nature, not to personal identification information, all sorts of crap that's on that. Do you think it's possible that our system has been just breached numerous times because of this, and that we would just be unaware of things like that that have been going down? I would hate to think that. I want to think that that's the first time that they've done it, but I in my mind, I'm like, there's no way, you know. If you made it all the way to the Pentagon, you've broken through, you know, security measure after security measure until you finally made it to the Pentagon before they were able to pick up on it.
It's really scary. So I did data breach work back in my prior job, working for a law firm, and companies would get breached and they'd be like, oh my gosh, we just discovered this hack. What do we do? Well, the discovery of the hack is ex post facto. The hack's already happened. It might have happened yesterday. It might have happened 6 months ago. It might have happened 6 years ago, but you are just discovering it today. So when the military, the Pentagon, for example, discovered the hack that you're referring to back in 2012, it might have been going on for several years or several weeks or several months. The speed with which data can flow is incredible. And this is something that I've been working on since the early 2000s, back when I was at the Federal Trade Commission, trying to harden our not only critical infrastructure, but our own personal devices and systems against potential foreign threats. I wish to say that, you know, you can't really do anything about it because you and I are kind of powerless, but this kind of gets back to the notion of government hamstringing our innovation, because the cyber attacks have gone up. So the number of fraud's gone up 300% in the past couple of years under this administration. Mm-hmm. Americans lose over $10 billion a year to fraud. And a lot of that is being generated now by AI. So once again, the United States can write every single law. We could outlaw AI, but bad actors don't care. They do not care. Yeah, exactly. So what we need is to use good actors here in the United States to essentially, it's like spy versus spy, but it's AI versus AI. So it's like Jurassic Park, right? They'll continue to probe the fence like the raptors, trying to find that vulnerability. And we need to figure out where they're probing, stop them. The other thing, and these hacks are going on all the time. We need to start calling out foreign nations for their cybersecurity hacks. If you look at the recent hacks against Ukraine or our Western allies from Russian hackers, there's a pretty good reason why they're not hacking Russian government. Right. Same thing's true with the Chinese hackers who are only hacking apparently for countries that are not China and mm-hmm. Iran. So this is where the administration needs to start calling out bad adversaries for doing bad things and holding them accountable for their bad actions, because just think about it. The internet goes down for a day, we freak out. Now imagine it going down for a month.
Right.
I don't even, like, all of your electricity, it's terrifying to think of.
But, you know, it's crazy. My wife works in critical infrastructure on a global scale. And the more information I've gotten from her about, you know, we could use data centers, for example, and how much information stored there and how critical it is and how much stuff in this world actually operates off them. You know, if those things are able to get shut down, the amount of destruction it would cause is just it's unimaginable, to be perfectly honest. I look at countries Iran. You know, a lot of people look at Iran and they go, okay, well, it's Iran. They're just another Middle Eastern country. They're not great, but they're neglecting the fact that they've been working hand in hand with China. They've been working hand in hand with Russia for a while. Back during the Afghan war, I think it was around the same time the Pentagon ended up getting hacked into, maybe a couple of years later, there was a drone that reportedly had been crashed. You know, the U.S. said we accidentally crashed a drone inside of Iran. It was flying out of, you know, Bagram. And for some reason, you know, we had lost connectivity. And instead of it returning to where it came from, right, which is what they're programmed to do, instead of it doing that, it crashed. And then Iran showed up in perfect condition. The only reasonable explanation for that in Matt's brain is they hacked into the system, got control of that drone that was flying over their territory, and landed it. Yeah.
I mean, it's doable. Like, all of this is doable. If you think that your system is completely secure, it's probably not. I go out and I speak to a lot of people about this, and it's like, look, the government has a bunch of things that they have to do. So what can you do to protect yourself?
Right.
Because at the end of the day, that's kind of what we're limited to. And so I remember I was over at an elderly center talking to some folks, and, you know, I know people get hacked and stuff all the time. Something as simple as use a password keeper, use different passwords on every single website, and make sure that your own primary email address has a password you use nowhere else, is one of the smallest changes you can make, but it's one of the biggest impacts it can have. Because one of the things that we oftentimes see with something called a phishing attack, you'll get an email from something that looks like your bank, says, click here to your password needs to be reset. Click here and it looks like your bank. You put in your username and password. If you are using your email address as your bank password, for example, or you're using it on a website that gets hacked and somebody can get into your primary email account, they will have password resets sent to your primary email account where they can now get in. Right. And they will just begin getting into every single one of your bank and credit card accounts very easily. It's a very simple process for them. They operate at scale. And this is one of the simplest things. So while people like you, I, a bunch of people out there are calling on the administration to up its game to actually protect us from threats, foreign and domestic, simultaneously, we need to also protect ourselves, because right now this administration is not doing its job.
Yeah, I'm with you. With you 1,000%. And I'm gonna tell you right now, my viewers, and I'm gonna hit you with a question that I don't even think I let you guys know it was coming. But my viewers have been asking me, and they want to know. You are probably the closest person I've had on an expert on this particular topic. I've talked to a couple about them, and they're like, "Hell if I know, brother." When we start talking about EMPs, for some reason, people are extremely worried about EMPs. How big of a threat? You know, what's your take?
So, you know, whenever I talk about EMPs, I always tell people, you know, what's an EMP? It's like, have you ever seen the movie Ocean's 11? Not the original, but the Don Cheadle remake, where they actually use an EMP. Now it's a micronuclear device, right? That fries electronic devices. Mm-hmm. In the movie, the lights go out for 2 seconds and come back on. That's not how an EMP actually works. It fries circuit boards. And what's really scary about that is it's not as simple as turning the power back on. Literally, your computer, your cell phone, your tablet, anything with a computer chip in it, your car, our refrigerators die. They are useless until you replace the motherboard, until you actually go in and, like, they're bricked. Mm-hmm. They become bricks. And that is one of those things that does really scare me, because that is a nuclear technology that is not only accessible, but attainable by our foreign adversaries. This is why when we hear, or when in particular Carl speaking for Carl here, when I hear about the Iran nuclear deal, you think, oh, you know, they have to attach those nukes to a ICBM, an intercontinental ballistic missile, mm-hmm. not that big of a threat. That can be weaponized in many different ways. Dirty right. bombs, I think, are a little overrated in their threats. When it comes to EMPs, that is a micronuclear explosion that will fry electronics. Now, you detonate something like that near, for example, where you're talking about a power plant, requires every single circuit board in that power plant to be replaced. Right. You detonate that in a city center, you're looking at like sending something back to the Stone Age. Oh, the last movie reference I'll hit you with, the movie GoldenEye, of course, famously was an EMP device. So there you go. And the quote there was, they were going to hit London with an EMP and send England back to the Stone Age, because that's basically what it would do.
So how large of an explosion do you need to affect, like, how large of an EMP, like you said, you know, setting off a power plant? Say I want to knock a power plant out, or say I want to knock out a substation. Do you know how large or how much?
No, ironically, that's actually my brother's universe. So my brother's the nuclear expert. I just live in IT world, but that's really what scares me. I mean, I will tell you, one of the big challenges that we're seeing in the US, because we're talking about energy, is our lack of energy independence right now. One of the biggest benefits mm-hmm. we could have is nuclear energy. Now, nuclear energy is, you know, clean for the most part. My family spent a lot of time in nuclear energy. And to the extent that something would go bad, nuclear power plants are actually developed now in a way that they could actually remove all the control rods and still not have a meltdown. Mm-hmm. So they are actually incredibly safe these days. Completely different issue from what I spend my day-to-day working on. But as a, you know, American, as a dad who wants to hand down a America that's better than the one I inherited, we need to really start to accept the ability of nuclear energy. And in fact, I asked my brother about this the other day. America has fewer nuclear power plants than Europe. And to put that in context, you mentioned you live in Texas. All of Western Europe can fit inside the state of Texas.
Right.
Well, so you know, we are way behind on this.
And it's incredibly efficient. I've talked about this before. You know, like, it's incredibly efficient. The problem is that it goes into the red tape. You know, you're talking about years and years and years of red tape just to get a new one online here in the United States. And we're pushing more to the green energy side here over the United States as well. And that doesn't really fit that agenda. So as opposed from having that tiny little footprint and burying the waste afterwards, you know, we're taking miles upon miles upon miles of land and just standing up these gigantic freaking fans everywhere. You know, you drive across Texas, you know, once you get out to the open area, that's what you see. When in reality, you could have just dropped a nuke plant in there and called it a day and not had to worry about any of it. It's mind numbing to me. And I think it all goes back to Chernobyl
it was Three Mile Island, actually.
That too, you know, and then Fukushima.
We haven't licensed a nuclear plant since the 1970s because of that. But one of the things about, you know, coming full circle on AI, one of the things AI is being used today is actually increasing energy efficiency and transmission. So part of our critical infrastructure that is way underinvested in and quickly aging or already aged is our electric wires. So the simple wires that carry electricity from the power plant to the grid are so inefficient. We lose tons of energy. So one of the things AI is trying to do is figure out more efficient ways to get that energy to the grid. And then once it's on the grid, to use that energy efficiently rather than continuously waste it. Because Lord knows my energy bills are certainly high enough as is.
You know, I had a lineman call into the show the other day, and he said that he is constantly replacing lines that are sometimes 60 plus years old that are still attached to the grid. It's one of the things that my wife's talked to me about before on, you know, how susceptible we are. And when we talk about our government failing us, it's one of those big things that we're looking at, you know, again, critical infrastructure, things that need to be maintained in order for it to happen. And it's not something that is a conspiracy theory. It's out there and it's real. You know, we have lines that are so old that I'm surprised they're still operating. It blows my mind. Like you said, inefficient. It's just.
But it gets back to your regulatory red tape. So I'll just tell you from where I live, we replaced a pedestrian bridge, and half the costs of replacing a pedestrian bridge were regulatory red tape, environmental impact assessments, zoning, all this stuff. And when it comes to replacing power lines, it's the same fundamental problem. If you look at there's a highway, I-95 is the main corridor that runs up and down the East Coast. Mm-hmm. And it famously had a bridge collapse outside of Philadelphia. Now remember, I-95 is the main corridor for a lot of people who live in New York and Boston to get to DC. So they drive that a lot. They were able to rebuild that bridge in 2 days. 2 days they rebuilt it because they suspended all the regulatory red tape. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of the biggest challenges that we see, whether it's in AI, whether it's in technology, whether it's in something as simple as replacing a power cable. We need to have government kind of get out of the way and let Americans lead, Americans develop, and Americans basically be able to make the changes that make life better for everyone.
Well, and I think that's possibly kind of the scary part for our government when it comes to AI, in my opinion. You know, we've a great example that anybody could look up, right, is there's a gentleman on Shark Tank the other day that developed a screen that goes in your nose and it prevents you from getting, like, you know, allergies, you know, a lot of your, you know, dust-borne allergies that you're going to end up getting in your sinuses prevents it. And they were like, hey, man, why don't you just license this out, anything like that? And he goes, well, none of the big pharma wants to buy it. You know, they want to buy it, but they're going to shelf it because they'd rather, you know, treat it because they're going to get more money out of it versus anything else. And I think when we look at civilians having access to that type of information, that AI, well, now that information, that power gets in the public hands, they're going to be able to start seeing those different things and presenting it going, here it is. We have the solution. It's right here. And I think that personally is what's scaring our government, what's scaring pharma, what's scaring all of these, you know, other lobbyists and donors are going to be pushing things up to the government. Scares the hell out of them, in my opinion. I really think that's what it is.
I mean, you're absolutely right. One, the biggest and the best thing about the internet is never before in the course of human history have so many people had so much access to so much information. And I use that phrase, but it's really stuck with me. Sundar Pichai, who's the CEO of Google, has this really good, he was born in India. He was born very poor in India. And when he was young, he got like volume few of the encyclopedia. And it was like amazing because he had access. Now kids in India have access to not only the entire encyclopedia, but the entire history of the world. And exactly the point that you're making is no longer do we have the historical gatekeepers. And it scares the crud out of those who want to control access to information. This is circles back to what we were talking about, government control of free speech on the internet. It can no longer be just Joe Biden says something, the newspapers print it, and that's all we know. Mm-hmm. We can now actually have real conversations, because if we relied exclusively on newspapers, we would think the Israelis blew up a hospital in Gaza, when it turns out the internet was able to quickly dispel that completely false narrative.
And you know what's nuts about that incident in particular? You know, when that was happening, that was going down, I was on my way over to actually run a live broadcast as that was going down, and that information had came out. And by the time I sat in the chair, we're talking about a 30-minute time span, and I sat down with my buddy, who also happens to be a vet, you know, and we looked at it and we go, no, that's not factually correct. You know, you can clearly see what was streamed on Al Jazeera. You can clearly see it was a rocket that malfunctioned and ended up splashing down. That's not a bomb. The next day, we ended up seeing the damage on the ground. It doesn't take an expert to look and say, you know, battle damage assessment or crater analysis does not equate to a 500 or even a 250-pound bomb, let alone a 2,000-pound bomb. You know, that is a very small rocket that ended up slamming into there. My fear, right, is that because everything is opened up, now we were able to blast that out in under an hour of it being reported. But it got left up online for so long, you know, and that's one of the things that troubles me about it. I got left up online for so long. But the second part is that type of information should be something that gets immediately blasted out to counter it. And it didn't. And what we ended up seeing was you know, riots at U.S. embassies around the world. We saw increased attacks against Israel. We saw people here in America extremely ticked off over it. And I mean, U.S. service members undoubtedly, you know, were attacked because of that. And it's scary to me that the ability for us to easily put information out like that, that counteracts that narrative that gets put out by mainstream media, might get stripped and taken away, you know, because it does play a huge role and it does play a huge part. The amount of college kids that I've talked to that tell me they get all of their information from social media. It's not even about mainstream media anymore. It's, we get the bulk of it from social media. Sometimes they'll get it from over here. Sometimes they'll get it from over here. And when you ask them if they validate it, their answer is no.
I think a lot of that goes back to, like, people no longer trust the quote unquote legacy news media. And the you know, New York Times, Washington Post, the LA Times, Boston Herald, Chicago Tribune, the trust in legacy media, whether it's that or just TV news,
right,
has gone down because they are so quick to print without verifying the accuracy sometimes of their stories. I mean, the Israel allegedly, you know, falsely being accused of bombing a hospital, that's front page of the New York Times. Front page of the New York Times. And that's how people lose trust in legacy media. And a lot of people don't know where to turn for legitimate information. So when they hear something on social media, then they're just as likely to take it because they don't know where else to get legitimate information. I think that's the big challenge for a lot of news industry, is to regain trust that has rightfully been lost. I think especially over the course of the Trump administration, a lot of that trust was lost.
I don't know if they're going to be perfectly honest with you. I really don't. And I really hope they can, but it's very apparent at this point that, you know, CNN has become extremely, you know, left-leaning, Fox News has become extremely right-leaning, and even people that, you know, claim to be independent, and they all have an agenda that ends up going in it. And it's very rare that you find somebody that'll do both sides and show you facts or give you the information presented behind the facts. And I think that would help out greatly in this country, but I don't think we're going to get it anytime soon because there's too much money involved. That's at the end of the day.
It's money and like trust, right? Lifetime to build, seconds to lose.
Right. Right. I greatly appreciate you coming on. I'll tell you what, how can we support you and your efforts for everything that you're out there doing in the world?
Well, I mean, essentially, you can like, follow, and subscribe, as the kids say. You can follow me on X. I'm at Carl Szabo, C-A-R-L-S-Z-A, B's and Boy O's in October. You can follow my company, NetChoice. We're on X at NetChoice, N-E-T-C-H-O-I-C-E. Or our website, netchoice.org, where you can see all about our efforts that literally I wake up every day trying to protect free speech and free enterprise on the internet. That's what I've been doing. That's what I do.
And it's important work, believe it or not. You know, there's a lot of people that are out there, you know, 2A this, 2A that, but really the same thing that goes into the Second Amendment, I think, applies to the first. You know, look, the internet wasn't around when this nation was founded. Social media wasn't around when this nation was founded. What you and I are doing, our founding fathers would have probably never been able to even conceptualize. So it's very important to be able to, like, you know, back that up and ensure that it's around for generations to come. Otherwise, Lord only knows what's going to happen. You know, people's minds are going to get warped really fast with disinformation if it's not protected.
It's one of the greatest things. So what is the secret sauce of the United States? I thought about this quite a while, quite a lot. It is a couple things. One, it is our foundational basis of free speech. You look at our neighbors to the north, to the south, across the pond in Europe, they will and are very happy to tell you what speech is illegal and what speech is allowed.
Sure.
Can't do that here. It makes us freak out. And the second secret sauce is our freedoms to innovate, develop, and create. Because at its core, America is power of the people that is given to the government, not the other way around. And more we remember that we, the people, are the basis of this government, mm-hmm. is the better that we will do going forward.
The amount of times I've had to remind people when they start telling me that we have, like, you know, a dictatorship or a government, it doesn't matter who's up there and who's in there. It's like, hey, they're elected representatives of the people for the most part. And they're the ones that are passing and making laws as representatives of the people. You don't have somebody that's just up in the government that's just, you know, slamming a stamp down and saying this is law, smashing a gavel every 2 minutes, minus the Supreme Court. But, you know, they're interpreting versus, you know, making, which is what they should be doing, right? That's what they're there for. But other than that, people, you know, I really think with the amount of information that we have in today's world, it just feels like we should be a hell of a lot more educated, you know. And it's sad when you can't have, you know, kids going into college pass a basic U.S. entrance exam test for, say, you know, immigrants, or I don't know. You know, there's so much I could talk to you about right now, and I don't want to take any more time. I'll give you the last word. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, absolutely. Look, this is the greatest nation on the planet. And the more and more we can remind people of that, I suspect a lot of people watching the show are intimately familiar, but it's the greatest nation on the face of the planet. There's a reason why everybody wants to come here. It is the place where anyone can dream, build, create, and truly live the American dream. And that's the message that we need to spread. And that is done by protecting our foundational freedoms of speech, innovation, and enterprise.
Yeah. You know, I'm bringing on a pro-Palestinian guy on Wednesday for an interview. And the reason I mean, he understands his rights and he understands American rights, or so it would seem. And I look forward to actually having a discussion with that. And I think that's something that this country needs to get back to. I think we need to get back to having open discussions with other people of opposing points of view. Just because they think different than you and I, they're not the enemy.
Yeah, you can't be afraid to hear an opinion that is different from your own.
Right.
And you need to be challenged. And you need to be provoked, because unless you do, you're never going to, like, understanding is a three-edged sword, right? Your side, their side, and the truth.
Sure.
So you gotta have information.
It kills me that people aren't willing to do that these days. It's very important. But again, you also you can't just be shouting over the top of it. You know, you gotta have, in order to understand you, you've got to be able to articulate what it is that your point is. And I hope my feeling is that most Americans fit in that category, and it's just what mainstream media and just what social media puts out that makes it seem like it's not. So,
most of silent majority is the old adage.
Oh yeah. The silent majority, my friend. Well, thank you very much for your time. I greatly appreciate
it. No, thanks so much. It's been great.
Carl, it was a pleasure having you on the show. I really look forward to the next time we're going to talk. I hope y'all back at home enjoyed this interview with Carl Sabo, ladies and gentlemen. Peace, love, happiness. God bless. I'm out of here.